Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. An international group of nations led by the U.S. and Italy agreed to back Libya's call for a lifting of sanctions on arms shipments to that North African country. Italy's Foreign Minister Paolo Gentiloni said Libya stabilization is key to several challenges.
With stabilization, we can fight terrorism. We can assure development to a country with rich potentialities, but with a strong humanitarian crisis now. We can tackle the migration issue. We can develop the resources of Libya. Without stabilization, we risk tensions, divisions, and intra-Libyan fights.
An embargo was imposed in 2011 to try to end militia violence. Meanwhile, U.S. defense spokesman Peter Cook said Monday small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Libya to try to gain intelligence on the Islamic State group.
Effectively meeting and getting a better sense of the players on the ground so that we have a sense of, for example, ISIL's presence in Libya, the level of strength, and the level of strength as well as some of those other forces on the ground. But I'm not going to characterize it other than to say these are small groups of Americans who have, again, maintained a small presence in Libya.
While the West has ruled out any kind of ground intervention, the U.S. has conducted airstrikes against IS targets. Detained Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye has been transferred back from the country's remote northeast to a Kampala prison charged with treason. Besigye lost his bid in February to unseat longtime incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. This is VOA News. The leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan agreed Monday to a ceasefire and peaceful settlement of their conflict over the disputed breakaway enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. The Vienna meeting, organized by the so-called Minsk group involving the U.S., Russia, and France. U.S. spokesman John Kirby Monday said Washington wants to see an end to the fighting.
This isn't about arbitration or mediation, but it's important to us to see the tension de-escalate, to see the violence stop, to see the ceasefire observed, and to see the parties start to work towards a better outcome.
The meeting, the first between Armenia's president Serzh Sargsyan and Azeri leader Ilham Aliyev since last month's clashes that killed dozens. Turkey is on high alert after intelligence officials warned of possible imminent Islamic State bombing attacks as Turks prepare to celebrate a national holiday. Media reports say IS is planning to attack Turkey's founding father, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's mausoleum Thursday, when youth sports activities are held marking Atatürk's campaign against occupation in 1919. IS has claimed responsibility in recent months for several attacks in big cities in Turkey that have killed dozens and wounded hundreds. Hundreds of workers at a network of oil camps in the Canadian province of Alberta have been ordered to evacuate in the face of advancing wildfires. Rachel Notley is the Alberta premier.
The fire is moving north at a fairly good pace recently crossed Tower Road. A mandatory evacuation has been put in place for several small camps along Astra Road, and it amounts to about 500 to 600 people being evacuated north to Suncor and Syncrude.
The fires are burning around the oil sands town of Fort McMurray, largely spared from earlier fires that scorched tens of thousands of hectares of land. Dominican Republic President Danilo Medina is celebrating his apparent landslide victory in Sunday's election in that Caribbean nation. With 60% of the vote tallied, Mr. Medina leads with 62%, indicating a runoff second-round ballot won't be necessary. His nearest opponent is businessman Luis Abinader with 35%. Mr. Medina's centrist PLD party has been in power for a dozen years. A Stockholm court Monday sentenced a Swedish citizen of Rwandan descent to life in prison for genocide and war crimes for his involvement in the African country's 1994 massacres. 61-year-old Claver Berenkiti, who moved to Sweden in 2002, was sentenced by a Rwandan court in absentia back in 2007 to 30 years in prison. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett has taken a billion-dollar stake in high-tech giant Apple. His decision comes as Apple stock skidded to its lowest level in 2 years. Apple shares rose on the news of Buffett's investment. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. denies it is pushing for a regime change in South Africa.
The U.S. does not regard the democratically elected government of South Africa and its strong democratic institutions as a regime, and their claims that we seek to undermine South African democracy run contrary to the spirit of the proud and long-standing relationship we have with South Africa.
Cindy Harvey is a spokesperson for the U.S. Embassy in South Africa. 28 million South Africans are hungry in El Nino-related drought. Ugandan authorities transfer Chisa Besigye to a maximum security prison in Kampala. And Nigerian labor and civil society groups say their strike planned for this Wednesday against fuel hike prices will go on.
Issues are clear. The pressure for the strike is on. There is no way that any discussion now with the government will affect the strike except there is a reversal.
Abiodun Aremu is the Secretary General of the Labor and Civil Society Coalition of Nigeria. A corruption probe nabs 14 more Cameroonian officials, and World Health Organization guidelines aim to help millions of female genital mutilation victims. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party has accused the U.S. government of trying to undermine the government of President Jacob Zuma. Johannesburg viewer's Anita Powell has more on the story, including the U.S. Embassy's strong denial.
The last time a top South African politician accused the U.S. government of trying to foment regime change, in February, the U.S. ambassador laughed it off. Ambassador Patrick Gaspard quipped, "If I organized a coup, it would look like Mardi Gras. Food, music, dance." But diplomats from both countries are no longer laughing at renewed allegations from the African National Congress. This time, party spokesman Zizi Kodwa told local media the U.S. government is trying to undermine the democratically elected government. Representatives from both governments were quick to refute his claims, including South African Foreign Ministry spokesman Clayson Monyela.
"Those are not our views as government. From the government's point of view, our relations with the United States are strong, they are warm and cordial."
Kodwa's comments come on the heels of a British newspaper report that asserts the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency helped South Africa's apartheid government arrest Nelson Mandela in 1962. That report quotes a now-dead retired CIA agent who said the United States saw South Africa's future president as a communist sympathizer. Kodwa said the CIA allegation is a serious indictment and stated the intelligence agency is still operating in South Africa. The spokesman did not respond to numerous calls Monday from VOA News seeking comment. U.S. Embassy spokeswoman Cindy Harvey strenuously denied the claims.
"Really, you know, South Africa is a strategic partner and a friend of the United States. The U.S. does not regard the democratically elected government of South Africa and its strong democratic institutions as a regime. And their claims that we seek to undermine South African democracy run contrary to the spirit of the proud and longstanding relationship we have with South Africa."
Harvey said the U.S. Embassy has no information on alleged CIA operations in South Africa in the 1960s. Harvey and Monyela said their governments are committed to a strong relationship. But South Africa in recent years has clearly drifted away from the West, most notably by joining the economic bloc known as BRICS, which is comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The land is dry, and so are the rivers in southern Africa, where crops are scarce and 28 million people are hungry. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Mozi in Zimbabwe, where the head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is calling for the world to help.
"The children show more life than adults during this El Nino-induced drought in Muzi district, about 250 kilometers east of Harare, one of the hardest hit areas in Zimbabwe. International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies Secretary General Elhaj Assisi is visiting Southern Africa to assess the food insecurity situation in the region. She told VOA he had touching moments in Malawi and Zimbabwe, the most affected countries.
"And what is touching is, of course, proud fathers and mothers who, like you and me, would wake up every day, care for themselves and their children, now depending overnight, you know, on either cash transfer programs we're giving to them or food we're giving to them, and see their dignity eroded, you know, by the way, and that is very touching. What is touching is to see children that go to bed hungry, children that may not go to school, and a mother having to listen to, you know, the children crying and have no food to give to them. I mean, that is profoundly, profoundly touching and totally unacceptable.
On Tuesday, C is expected to launch an appeal for $150 million to avert hunger in Southern Africa. 60-year-old Mabel Nyamono from Mudzi is one of those looking forward to funding increasing in Zimbabwe.
She
says here there is real hunger. Most of the days, kids go to school on an empty stomach and may go for 3 or 4 days without a decent meal. In Mudzi district, the Zimbabwe Red Cross gives cash handouts of $40 a month to 1,222 families. In a country with a poverty line estimated to be just more than $500, that amount is probably a drop in the ocean, as the adage goes. The meeting will bring together UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and international aid groups in an effort to come up with a plan that builds resilience in countries facing catastrophe, such as drought affecting Southern Africa. Sebastian Mofu, VOA News, Mudzi, Zimbabwe.
Ugandan authorities on Monday transferred former Forum for Democratic Change presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye from Moroto Prison in the north of the country to the maximum security Luzira Prison in Kampala. Besigye, who has claimed he won the February 18th election, was arrested last week and charged with treason after a video surfaced showing he had been sworn in by his party as president of Uganda. Moroto Court resident state attorney Peter Amalo said Dr. Besigye was transferred to Kampala because he is a former presidential candidate and needs to be kept in a prison suitable for his stature. Olive Kobusinge is Dr. Besigye's sister, who visited him at Moroto Prison before he was transferred. She says the authorities are trying to break Dr. Besigye's spirit, but it might have backfired.
He's in good spirits. He looks much better than I feared he would. And, it was a big relief for me because I wasn't sure what to expect. But, yeah, he's quite upbeat. He's in good spirits.
Olive, tell us, how long did it take you to get to where they've taken him?
Okay, so this is a really distant place. It was a 10-hour drive. The first 5 hours or so are pretty good. It's on a good road. I mean, you get off the good road, and it's a really long and rough ride to get here. Certainly, the best way to get here, the easiest would be to fly here if you have the means, because the drive is really long.
When you say fly, you mean in helicopter or what?
Yeah. There are, as far as I'm aware, there are no scheduled commercial flights. So I guess the only way one would do it is to charter a plane, which clearly is beyond most people's means. So, yeah, I guess the only way we have to get to him is to drive here.
I read in the Uganda Monitor, someone did an interview with him from his prison cell, where Dr. Besigye questioned why they did not charge him in Kampala. Instead, they have to bring him to where you are. Did he express that?
Yeah, it's, I guess, been very surprising to most people. I mean, virtually every lawyer that I've spoken to says there's absolutely no reason for him to be here. Whatever offenses he's alleged to have committed weren't committed here or anywhere close to where he is right now. So I think it's clear that it was meant to distance him from what they perceive to be his strongest support and to put him away from his lawyers, for instance, who haven't been able to access him. And the only way they can access him is to do the 10-hour drive here, because he doesn't have access to a phone. And even when you go to visit him, I mean, you search, they ensure that you don't have any form of communication other than you physically being talking to him. I guess one of the ironies of bringing him to this place is if the state had hoped that they were going to put him in a place where he has absolutely no support, they have been unsuccessful, because they lots of local people that have been, you know, coming to the when he was at the police station, even now that he's in prison. So local people have been very determined to make sure that he is well looked after. There have been people here. The SDC chairperson has been, you know, personally responsible for his meals. We've had relatives that come from this area that are cooking his meals, and they're being able to take them into the prison for him to have decent meals.
Olive Kobu Singe is the Dr. Besigye's sister. She was speaking with me from Moroto in northern Uganda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 17th. Let's say a shout-out to our listeners on Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, and Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Cameroon has arrested and jailed more than a dozen government administrators and project managers in a crackdown on corruption. But many think President Paul Biya, who has been in power for 34 years, is trying to silence his opponents. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Among the 14 senior state officials arrested and detained within the past 2 weeks is Joseph André Eyebe Ayebe, the highest-ranking government official in the western town of Bangante. Cameroon's justice ministry says he and 13 others were charged by the country's special criminal tribunal for corruption cases and taken to prison in Yaoundé, the capital. Justice Ministry spokesman Etienne Dika says the 14 men are accused of embezzling $9 million that was to be paid as compensation for people evicted from land used for the construction of a deep sea port in Kribi.
Si effectivement on trouve qu'ils ont soit dérobé de l'argent, ils ont détourné l'argent, ils ont
Zika says Cameroonians who have been advocating for transparency should assist the government in its fight against corruption instead of complaining of political witch hunting. He said charging the accused will help establish the truth. At least 24 former officials, including immediate past Prime Minister Ephrem Inoni and heads of state corporations, have been arrested in what the government says is a campaign against corruption. Among them is former senior government minister Marafa Hamidou Yaya, who insists they are victims of President Paul Biya's desire to stay in power for life. In a letter to journalists, Yaya states that in 2008, he advised Biya not to change the constitution that limited his mandate, but the president neglected his calls, changed the constitution, ran for president, and was declared the winner. Etienne Hamann of Cameroon's non-governmental organization, People's Rights, says it looks like the anti-corruption campaign targets Biya's opponents. He says people think the detention of corrupt officials has political undertones because corruption has continued despite the mass arrest and detention of suspects. He says many Cameroonians are indifferent about the arrests that were originally intended to discourage the theft of public funds. The state estimates $152 million in public funds has been stolen. Cameroon law states corruption suspects can be detained and their travel documents seized during investigations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Nigeria's labor and civil society groups say their strike planned for tomorrow Wednesday against hike in fuel prices will go on as scheduled. The Nigeria Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress had called for an indefinite strike unless the price of gasoline was reduced from 145 naira or 75 cents per gallon to 86.5 naira per gallon. The government recommended the increases to end shortages caused by foreign exchange crisis. The government announced Monday it has scheduled talks with the union, but Abiodun Aremu, Secretary General of the Labor and Civil Society Coalition of Nigeria, says the government must first rescind the act imposing the fuel price hike before any talks will take place because the government imposed the hike unilaterally.
With respect to the current strike and mass action, the issues are basically two. We are demanding the reversal not only the fuel hike from 145 back to 26 naira 50, we are also demanding the reversal of the electricity hike that was done on February 1st, 2016. Issues are clear. The preparations for the strike is on. There is no way that any discussion now with the government will affect the strike except there is a reversal, because the government did not consult with us before it unilaterally imposed that hike.
The story in the day on Monday was that the union and its allies, including you, were meeting with the government.
That position was not correct. What happened was that after the government made an overture to labor, and the labor leadership insisted that they must formalize their invitation to meet with them. And the position of the NLC, TUC, and JAF, and the civil society on this matter is clear. For any meaningful discussions on those reversals, the government must reverse first, because we are never consulted before that unilateral imposition. As a matter of fact, at the Lagos headquarters here, by 12 noon tomorrow, there will be a media press conference to announce the natures of the actions that is beginning on Wednesday.
Mr. Arimu, the way we understand it is that the government increased the price of petrol to end the shortages caused by foreign exchange crisis, particularly also because of the slump in the price of oil globally. So are you not concerned about the economic impact if there is any strike?
You see, let's put the issue clearly. The issue of deregulation in Nigeria is a policy used to enrich the few rich class in Nigeria and punish the poor. You see, the foreign exchange could not be an excuse. And let's clear the air on subsidy. What actually is happening, and that's the monumental fraud, which the presidency is afraid to confront, is that each time they are supposed to be subsidized fuel products, what happened is that all the independent marketers are paid for fuel that they are not supplying. That is the critical problem that we have in the country. As we stand today now, there is none of the marketers that has imported a single liter of fuel into the country since they have hiked the prices. Yet the same marketers are selling at above 145 naira.
Abiodun Aremu is Secretary General of the Labour and Civil Society Coalition of Nigeria. You are speaking with me from Lagos, Nigeria. The World Health Organization has issued its first ever guidelines to help health workers provide better physical and psychological care to the more than 200 million girls and women worldwide who are living with female genital mutilation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Every year, the World Health Organization reports some 3 million girls, most under age 15, are subject to female genital mutilation. This number adds to the hefty toll of more than 200 million girls and women already living with the harmful consequences of this brutal, inhumane practice. Female genital mutilation, or FGM, involves the partial or total removal of external genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. The practice is highly prevalent in 30 African countries and a few countries in Asia and the Middle East. With increased global migration, more cases of FGM are occurring in Europe and North America. Coordinator in WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research, Lale Sai, says FGM can cause immediate problems such as pain, severe bleeding, and even death.
It has high risks during pregnancy and childbirth, both for the woman who is delivering, but also for her baby. It can cause obstetric tears, difficult labor, and even loss of the baby at the time of the delivery. Other health problems, longer-term health problems, include psychological risks, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder.
WHO notes health workers often are unaware of the negative consequences of FGM and do not know how to treat them. The health agency's recommendations focus on preventing and treating obstetric complications and on helping women with depression and anxiety disorders. The guidelines also warn against the so-called medicalization of FGM. WHO medical officers Officer Doris Chu says doctors must refuse requests from family members to perform FGM, believing that to be a safer procedure.
Medicalization is never acceptable because it violates medical ethics, as it is a harmful practice. Medicalization itself perpetuates FGM, and the risks outweigh any perceived benefits. But as healthcare providers, we actually need to recall that we need to uphold the Hippocratic Oath, and that is to do no harm.
WHO says the guidelines can help ongoing global efforts to end female genital mutilation by better informing the health community about the many health risks associated with FGM. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Oman in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Nigeria's All-Africa Games silver medalist Patience George Okon clocked 52.11 seconds in 400 meters to attain the Olympic qualifier for the women's one-lap event at the first Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meeting in the capital Abuja on Saturday. Divine Oduduru and Obinna Metu showed promise in men's 200 meters, winning their separate heats in 20.64 and 20.65 seconds respectively, while Orukpe Erayokan won the men's 400 meters in 46.41 seconds. Ogo Egene and Uko Alfonso's piece triumphed in the men's and women's 100 meters in 10.24 seconds and 11.52 seconds respectively. Henry Okori clocked 52.24 seconds to win the men's 400-meter hurdles, as Daisy Akpofu prevailed in the women's version in 58.43 seconds. On the infield, Commonwealth Games champion Brume Ese prevailed in women's long jump with a leap of 6.54 meters, as Ibrahim Blessing Ibukun won women's triple jump in 13.60 meters. On a sad note, Wolde Meskel Kostre, the coach behind the successes of former and current world record holder, along with multiple world and Olympic champions Haile Gebrselassie, Kenenisa Bekele, Tirunish Dibaba, and Deratu Tulu, passed away after a long illness in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on Monday. Gebrselassie attributes their success to Coach Kostre's strict regime in training. In basketball, Tunisia edged their Chinese hosts, Jiangsu Lions, 69-63 in Jiangsu, some 1,000 kilometers south of the Chinese capital, Beijing. The Tunisians are in China preparing for the men's basketball Olympic qualifying tournament in Turin, Italy in July. In football, hosts South Africa pipped Zimbabwe by a solitary goal in a women's friendly match in Johannesburg on Sunday. Both teams are gearing up to represent Africa in women's football at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. In Tunisia, Stade Gabesian host the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe in the return leg of their Orange Africa Confederations Cup tie in Gabès, some 410 kilometers south of the Tunisian capital Tunis, today, Tuesday. TP Mazembe won the first leg 1-0. Meanwhile, Tunisia's Esperance engage Algeria's Mouloudia Bejaia. The two drew 0-0 in the first leg played in Algiers. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Monk. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news for the third Monday in the month. Hundreds of protesters gather in Nairobi to demand major reforms in the country's electoral commission, starting with the resignation of the commission members. Protesters also took place in Western Kenya. The protesters, most of whom are supporters of the opposition core coalition, accused the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission of favoring the ruling Jubilee coalition. And that is it for this Tuesday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, I'm James Barty in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Donald Trump